Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, we'll hear the conclusion of The Adventure of the Dying Detective, a classic Sherlock Holmes tale by Arthur Conan Doyle, read by Lucas Vanderwald. When we left off, the famous detective had taken ill and was lying in his deathbed. Dr. Watson had just been persuaded by Holmes to hide behind the headboard of his bed in order to eavesdrop on a conversation between Holmes and the mysterious Mr. Culverton Smith, who has just arrived at Sherlock Holmes' request. Let's rejoin the story. Here's Lucas Vanderwald reading The Adventure of the Dying Detective by Arthur Conan Doyle.
From the hiding place into which I had been so swiftly hustled, I heard the footfalls upon the stair with the opening and the closing of the bedroom door. Then, to my surprise, there came a long silence, broken only by the heavy breathings and gaspings of the sick man. I could imagine that our visitor was standing by the bedside and looking down at the sufferer. At last that strange hush was broken. "Holmes!" he cried. "Holmes!" in the insistent tone of one who awakens a sleeper. "Can't you hear me, Holmes?" There was a rustling as if he had shaken the sick man roughly by the shoulder. "Is that you, Mr. Smith?" Holmes whispered. "I hardly dared hope that you would come." The other laughed. "I should imagine not," he said. "And yet, you see, I am here. Coals of fire, Holmes, coals of fire." "It is very good of you, very noble of you. I appreciate your special knowledge." Our visitor sniggered. "You do. You are, fortunately, the only man in London who does. Do you know what is the matter with you?" "The same," said Holmes. "Ah, you recognize the symptoms?" "Only too well." "Well, I shouldn't be surprised, Holmes. I shouldn't be surprised if it were the same. A bad lookout for you if it is. Poor Victor was a dead man on the fourth day, a strong, hearty young fellow. It was certainly, as you said, very surprising that he should have contracted an out-of-the-way Asiatic disease in the heart of London, a disease, too, of which I had made such a very special study. Singular coincidence, Holmes. Very smart of you to notice it, but rather uncharitable to suggest that it was cause and effect." "I knew that you did it." "Oh, you did you? Well, you couldn't prove it anyhow." "But what do you think of yourself spreading reports about me like that, and then crawling to me for help the moment you're in trouble? What sort of game is that, eh?" I heard the rasping, laboured breathing of the sick man. "Give me the water," he gasped. "You're precious near your end, my friend, but I don't want you to go till I've had a word with you. That's why I gave you water. There, don't slop it about. That's right. Can you understand what I say?" Holmes groaned. "Do what you can for me. Let bygones be bygones," he whispered. "I'll put the words out of my mind. I swear I will. Only cure me. I'll forget it."
"Forget what?"
"Well, about Victor Savage's death. You as good as admitted just now that you had done it. I'll forget it."
"You can forget it or remember it, just as you like. I don't see you in the witness box. Quite another shaped box, my good Holmes, I assure you. It matters nothing to me that you should know how my nephew died. It's not him we were talking about. It's you."
"Yes, yes. The fellow who came for me, I've forgotten his name, said that you contracted it down in the East End among the sailors." "I could only account for it so."
"You're proud of your brains, Holmes, are you not? Think yourself smart, don't you? You came across someone who was smarter this time. Now, cast your mind back. Holmes, can you think of no other way you could have got this thing?"
"I can't think. My mind is gone. For heaven's sake, help me."
"Yes, I will help you. I'll help you to understand just where you are and how you got there. I'd like you to know before you die."
"Give me something to ease my pain."
"Painful, is it? Yes, the coolies used to do some squealing toward the end. Takes you as cramp, I fancy."
"Yes, yes, it is cramp."
"Well, you can hear what I say, anyhow. Listen now. Can you remember any unusual incident in your life just about the time your symptoms began?"
"No, no, nothing."
"Think again."
"I'm too ill to think."
"Well, then, I'll help you. Did anything come by post?"
"By post?"
"A box, by chance."
"I'm fainting. I'm gone."
"Listen, Holmes."
There was a sound as if he was shaking the dying man, and it was all that I could do to hold myself quiet in my hiding place.
"You must hear me. You shall hear me. Do you remember a box, an ivory box? It came on Wednesday. You opened it. Do you remember?"
"Yes, yes, I opened it. There was a sharp spring inside. Some joke?"
"It was no joke, as you will find to your cost. You fool. You would have it, and you have got it. Who asked you to cross my path? If you had left me alone, I would not have hurt you.
I remember, Holmes gasped.
The spring, it drew blood. This box, this on the table. The very one, by George, and it may as well leave the room in my pocket. There goes your last shred of evidence. But you have the truth now, Holmes, and you can die with the knowledge that I killed you. You knew too much of the fate of Victor Savage, so I have sent you to share it. You're very near your end, Holmes. I will sit here, and I will watch you die.
Holmes' voice had sunk to an almost inaudible whisper.
What is that? Said Smith. Turn up the gas? Ah, the shadows begin to fall, do they? Yes, I will turn it up, that I may see you the better.
He crossed the room, and the light suddenly brightened.
Is there any other little service that I can do you, my friend?
A match and a cigarette. I nearly called out in my joy and amazement. He was speaking in his natural voice, a little weak perhaps, but the very voice I knew. There was a long pause, and I felt that Culverton Smith was standing in silent amazement, looking down at his companion.
"What's the meaning of this?" I heard him say at last in a dry, rasping tone.
"The best way of successfully acting a part is to be it," said Holmes. "I give you my word that for 3 days I have tasted neither food nor drink until you were good enough to pour me out that glass of water. But it is the tobacco which I find most irksome. Ah, here are some cigarettes." I heard the striking of a match. "That is very much better. Hello, hello, do I hear the step of a friend?" There were footfalls outside, and the door opened, and Inspector Morton appeared. "All is in order, and this is your man," said Holmes. The officer gave the usual cautions. "I arrest you on the charge of the murder of one Victor Savage," he concluded. "And you might add, of the attempted murder of one Sherlock Holmes," remarked my friend with a chuckle. "To save an invalid trouble, Inspector, Mr. Culverton Smith was good enough to give our signal by turning up the gas. By the way, the prisoner has a small box in the right-hand pocket of his coat, which it would be as well to remove. Thank you. I would handle it gingerly if I were you. Put it down here. It may play its part in the trial." There was a sudden rush and scuffle, followed by the clash of iron and a cry of pain. "You'll only get yourself hurt," said the inspector. "Stand still, will you?" There was the click of the closing handcuffs.
"A nice trap," cried the high, snarling voice. "It will bring you into the dock, Holmes, not me. He asked me to come here to cure him. I was sorry for him, and I came. Now he will pretend, no doubt, that I have said anything which he may invent, which will corroborate his insane suspicions. You can lie as you like, Holmes. My word is always as good as yours."
"Good heavens," cried Holmes. "I had totally forgotten him. My dear Watson, I owe you 1,000 apologies. To think that I should have overlooked you. I need not introduce you to Mr. Culverton Smith, since I understand that you met somewhat earlier in the evening. Have you the cab below? I will follow you when I am dressed, for I may be of some use at the station." "I never needed it more," said Holmes, as he refreshed himself with a glass of claret and some biscuits in the intervals of his toilet. "However, as you know, my habits are irregular, and such a feat means less to me than to most men. It was very essential that I should impress Mrs. Hudson with the reality of my condition, since she was to convey it to you, and you, in turn, to him. You won't be offended, Watson. You will realize that among your many talents, dissimulation finds no place, and that if you had shared my secret, you would never have been able to impress Smith with the urgent necessity of his presence, which was the vital point of the whole scheme. Knowing his vindictive nature, I was perfectly certain that he would come to look upon his handiwork."
"But your appearance, Holmes, your ghastly face!"
3 days of absolute fast does not improve one's beauty, Watson. For the rest, there is nothing which a sponge may not cure. With Vaseline upon one's forehead, belladonna in one's eyes, rouge over the cheekbones, and crusts of beeswax round one's lips, a very satisfying effect can be produced. Malingering is a subject upon which I have sometimes thought of writing a monograph. A little occasional talk about half-crowns, oysters, or any other extraneous subject produces a pleasing effect of delirium.
But why would you not let me near you, since there was in truth no infection? Can you ask, my dear Watson, do you imagine that I have no respect for your medical talents? Could I fancy that your astute judgment would pass a dying man who, however weak, had no rise of pulse or temperature? At 4 yards I could deceive you. If I failed to do so, who would bring Mr. Smith within my grasp?
No, Watson, I would not touch that box. You can just see, if you look at it sideways, where the sharp spring, like a viper's tooth, emerges as you open it. I dare say it was by some such device that poor Savage, who stood between this monster and a reversion, was done to death. My correspondence, however, is, as you know, a varied one, and I am somewhat upon my guard against any packages which reach me. It was clear to me, however, that by pretending that he had really succeeded in his design, I might surprise a confession. That pretense I have carried out with the thoroughness of the true artist. Thank you, Watson. You must help me on with my coat. When we have finished at the police station, I think that something nutritious at Simpson's would not be out of place.
That concludes The Adventure of the Dying Detective by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Now we'll begin another Sherlock Holmes tale read by Lucas Vanderwald. This adventure is titled His Last Bow, The War Service of Sherlock Holmes. The story was first published in September of 1917 in Strand Magazine, and was soon after republished in a collection of Sherlock Holmes stories also titled His Last Bow, Some Reminiscences of Sherlock Holmes. His Last Bow was published in the midst of World War I and details the great detective's service to his country at the onset of the war. As the war was still underway, many believed the story was written and published with the intention of boosting the morale of British readers. In the preface to the story, Sherlock Holmes's friend Dr. Watson assures the reader that Mr. Holmes has since retired to a peaceful life in the countryside. Here's Lucas Vanderwald reading His Last Bow, The War Service of Sherlock Holmes.
The friends of Mr. Sherlock Holmes will be glad to learn that he is still alive and well, though somewhat crippled by occasional attacks of rheumatism. He has for many years lived in a small farm upon the Downs, 5 miles from Eastbourne, where his time is divided between philosophy and agriculture. During this period of rest, he has refused the most princely offers to take up various cases, having determined that his retirement was a permanent one. The approach of the German war caused him, however, to lay his remarkable combination of intellectual and practical activity at the disposal of the government, with historical results which are recounted in this story. Signed, John H. Watson, M.D. His Last Bow, The War Service of Sherlock Holmes. It was 9 o'clock at night upon the 2nd of August, the most terrible August in the history of the world. One might have thought already that God's curse hung heavy over a degenerate world, but there was an awesome hush and a feeling of vague expectancy in the sultry and stagnant air. The sun had long set, but one blood-red gash lay like an open wound low in the distant west. Above, the stars were shining brightly, and below, the lights of the shipping glimmered in the bay. The two famous Germans stood beside the stone parapet of the garden walk, with the long, low, heavily gabled house behind them, and they looked down upon the broad sweep of the beach at the foot of the great chalk cliff, in which von Bork, like some wandering eagle, had perched himself 4 years before. They stood with their heads close together, talking in low, confidential tones. From below, the two glowing ends of their cigars might have been the smouldering eyes of some malignant fiend looking down in the darkness. A remarkable man, this von Bork, a man who could hardly be matched among all the devoted agents of the Kaiser. It was his talents which had first recommended him for the English mission, the most important mission of all. But since he had taken it over, those talents had become more and more manifest to the half-dozen people in the world who were really in touch with the truth. One of these was his present companion, Baron von Herling, the chief secretary of the legation, whose huge 100-horsepower Benz car was blocking the country lane as it waited to waft its owner back to London. So far as I can judge the trend of events, you will probably be back in Berlin within the week, the secretary was saying. When you get there, my dear von Bork, I think you will be surprised at the welcome you will receive. I happen to know what is thought in the highest quarters of your work in this country. He was a huge man, the secretary, deep, broad and tall, with a slow, heavy fashion of speech, which had been his main asset in his political career. Von Bork laughed. They are not very hard to deceive, he remarked. A more docile, simple folk could not be imagined. I don't know about that, said the other thoughtfully. They have strange limits, and one must learn to observe them. It is that surface simplicity of theirs which makes a trap for the stranger. One's first impression is that they are entirely soft. Then one suddenly comes upon something very hard, and you know you have reached the limit and must adapt yourself to the fact. They have, for example, their insular conventions, which simply must be observed. Meaning good form and that sort of thing? Von Bork sighed as one who had suffered much. Meaning British prejudice and all its queer manifestations. As an example, I may quote one of my own worst blunders. I can afford to talk of my blunders, for you know my work well enough to be aware of my successes. It was on my first arrival. I was invited to a weekend gathering at a country house of a cabinet minister. The conversation was amazingly indiscreet. Von Bork nodded. I've been there, he said dryly. Exactly. Well, I naturally sent a resume of the information to Berlin. Unfortunately, our good Chancellor is a little heavy-handed in these matters, and he transmitted a remark which showed that he was aware of what had been said. This, of course, took the trail straight up to me. You've no idea the harm that it did me. There was nothing soft about our British hosts on that occasion, I can assure you. I was 2 years living it down. Now you, with this sporting pose of yours... No, no, don't call it a pose. A pose is an artificial thing. This is quite natural. I'm a born sportsman. I enjoy it. Well, that makes it more effective. You yacht against them, you hunt with them, you play polo, you match them in every game. Your four-in-hand takes the prize at Olympia. I've even heard that you go to the length of boxing with the young officers. What is the result? Nobody takes you seriously. You are a good old sport, quite a decent fellow for a German. A hard-drinking, nightclub, knockabout-town, devil-may-care young fellow. And all the time, this quiet country house of yours is the centre of half the mischief in England, and the sporting squire the most astute secret service man in Europe. Genius, my dear von Bork, genius. You flatter me, Baron, but certainly I may claim my 4 years in this country have not been unproductive. I've never shown you my little store. Would you mind stepping in for a moment? The door of the study opened straight onto the terrace. Von Bork pushed it back, and, leading the way, he clicked the switch of the electric light. He then closed the door behind the bulky form which followed him and carefully adjusted the heavy curtain over the latticed window. Only when all these precautions had been taken and tested did he turn his sunburned aquiline face to his guest. "Some of my papers have gone," said he. "When my wife and the household left yesterday for Flushing, they took the less important with them. I must, of course, claim the protection of the embassy for the others." "Your name has already been filed as one of the personal suite. There will be no difficulties for you or your baggage. Of course, it is just possible that we may not have to go. England may leave France to her fate. We are sure that there is no binding treaty between them." "And Belgium?" "And Belgium, too." Von Bork shook his head. "I don't see how that could be. There is a definite treaty there. She could never recover from such a humiliation." "She would at least have peace for the moment. But her honour?" "My dear sir, we live in a utilitarian age. Honour is a medieval conception. Besides, England is not ready. It is an inconceivable thing, but even our special war tax of 50 million, which one would think made our purpose as clear as if we had advertised it on the front page of the Times, has not roused these people from their slumbers. Here and there one hears a question. It is my business to find an answer. Here and there there is also an irritation. It is my business to soothe it. But I can assure you that so far as the essentials go, the storage of munitions, the preparation for submarine attack, the arrangements for making high explosives, nothing is prepared. How, then, can England come in, especially when we have stirred up such a devil's brew of Irish civil war, window-breaking furies, and God knows what to keep her thoughts at home? She must think of her future. Ah, that is another matter. I fancy that in the future we have our own very definite plans about England, and that your information will be very vital to us. It is today or tomorrow with Mr. John Bull. If he prefers today, we are perfectly ready. If it is tomorrow, we shall be more ready still. I should think they would be wiser to fight with allies than without them, but that is their own affair. This week is their week of destiny. But you were speaking of your papers. He sat in the armchair with the light shining upon his broad, bald head while he puffed sedately at his cigar. The large oak-panelled book-lined room had a curtain hung in the further corner. When this was drawn, it disclosed a large, brass-bound safe. Von Bork detached a small key from his watch chain, and after some considerable manipulation of the lock, he swung open the heavy door. "Look," said he, standing clear with a wave of his hand. The light shone vividly into the open safe, and the secretary of the embassy gazed with an absorbed interest at the rows of stuffed pigeonholes with which it was furnished. Each pigeonhole had its label, and his eyes, as he glanced along them, read a long series of such titles as Fords, Harbour Defences, Aeroplanes, Ireland, Egypt, Portsmouth Forts, the Channel, Rosyth, and a score of others. Each compartment was bristling with papers and plans. "Colossal," said the secretary. Putting down his cigar, he softly clapped his fat hands. "And all in 4 years, Baron. Not such a bad show for the hard-drinking, hard-riding country squire. But the gem of my collection is coming, and there is the setting all ready for it." He pointed to a space over which Naval Signals was printed. "But you have a good dossier there already." "Out of date and waste paper. The Admiralty in some way got the alarm, and every code has been changed. It was a blow, Baron. The first setback in my whole campaign. But thanks to my checkbook and the good Altamont, all will be well tonight." The Baron looked at his watch and gave a guttural exclamation of disappointment. "Well, I really can wait no longer. You can imagine that things are moving at present in Carlton Terrace, and that we all have to be at our posts. I had hoped to be able to bring news of your great coup. Did Altamont name no hour?" Von Bork pushed over a telegram. "Will come without fail tonight and bring new sparking plugs. Altamont." "Sparking plugs, eh?" "You see, he poses as a motor expert, and I keep a full garage. In our code, everything likely to come up is named after some spare part. If he talks of a radiator, it is a battleship, of an oil pump, a cruiser, and so on. Sparking plugs are naval signals." "From Portsmouth at midday," the secretary said, examining the superscription. "By the way, what do you give him?" £500 for this particular job. Of course, he has a salary as well. The greedy rogue. They are useful, these traitors, but I grudge them their blood money. I grudge Altamont nothing. He's a wonderful worker. If I pay him well, at least he delivers the goods, to use his own phrase. Besides, he is not a traitor. I assure you that our most pan-Germanic Junker is a sucking dove in his feelings towards England as compared with a real bitter Irish-American. Oh, an Irish-American. If you heard him talk, you would not doubt it. Sometimes, I assure you, I can hardly understand him. He seems to have declared war on the King's English as well as on the English King. Must you really go? He may be here any moment. No, I'm sorry, but I have already overstayed my time. We shall expect you early tomorrow, and when you get that signal book through the little door on the Duke of York's steps, you can put a triumphant fini to your record in England. What? Tokay? He indicated a heavily sealed, dust-covered bottle which stood with two high glasses upon a salver. May I offer you a glass before your journey? No, thanks, but it looks like revelry. Altamont has a nice taste in vines, and he took a fancy to my Tokay. He's a touchy fellow, and he needs humouring in small things. I have to study him, I assure you.
That's where we have to leave tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure. Listen to tomorrow's episode of The Bookshelf to hear the conclusion of His Last Bow, The War Service of Sherlock Holmes. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. This episode was edited by Annie Mattson and produced by me, Chris Messini. Executive producer of The Bookshelf is Vern Windham. To listen back to this and many other episodes of The Bookshelf, subscribe to The Bookshelf podcast on your podcast app or at SpokanePublicRadio.org.